How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF. On today's episode, our environmental correspondent, Sylvia Richardson, interviews Paul Watson, an activist and author, co-founder of Greenpeace, and the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, about Canada's seal hunt.
It's not made money for half a century. It's just continually subsidized by the government. In fact, I've been advocating that the government pay the sealers to not kill seals. You know, we pay farmers to not grow wheat in a starving world. I think that we can certainly pay sealers to not provide fur for the fashion industry.
And Kim has interviewed Michael Brower, a faculty member and former director of the School of Environmental Health at UBC, about air pollution and environmental health.
Because of the way we've set up our society in this urban built environment, most people just in their day-to-day life aren't reminded enough, aren't aware enough of how we get air, how we get water, where does our drinking water come from, where does our food come from, what are we putting into our air. If people really just simply took the time to think about that, the connections are obvious.
I'm Kim Tay.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And you are listening to Sustainable Futures. So we have a mixed bag today, Ryan.
Yes, a couple of disjointed interviews put together, both on the topic of sustainability, or asking you listeners to stretch your mind to jump from one interview to the next.
Oh, I don't think it's that hard. Everything's interconnected when it comes to sustainability, so we'll find some theme.
That's true. And we have a very, very bright audience.
That's true, too. Mm-hmm. First up is an interview by Sylvia Richardson with Paul Watson. And he is, as we mentioned in the introduction, he's the co-founder of Greenpeace and the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. And he was nominated by Time Magazine as one of the environmental heroes of the 20th century in the year 2000. So I think that it's quite an honor to have an interview with him on the show. I heard a lot about him actually when the seal hunt was going on earlier in the year, how his ship had gone to intercept the slaughter. I think the important thing about taking a look at the seal hunt with regards to sustainability is that it has to do with a species and it has to do with conserving a species.
Well, seals are very important to the ocean environment. They are in the food chain, and so they're eaters and eaten, and they're depended on to be able to eat some animal life in the ocean, and also those that prey on them would also be missing out on their meals.
It's a very specific topic on the seal hunt, but I think that it has a greater message, and that being, you know, that we need to take care of our oceans. I mean, even Paul Watson in the interview, you'll hear him mention that our seas are at risk right now and we need to do more to protect them. One of those issues is the seal hunt and taking care of those larger species. But the seas in general are under threat right now. So I think that, you know, an interview like this kind of brings awareness to some of the damage that we're doing.
Yeah, the ocean environment is something that gets overlooked a lot, I think, just like factory farming gets overlooked a lot. There are things being done to our ocean environment that are very hazardous, and it tends to, perhaps because we're not spending our days in the ocean, it gets overlooked because it's not directly in front of us, but there is a lot going on.
So, with no further ado, here is Paul Watson.
Paul, I want to get started by asking you if you could please take us back to that day when you were arrested. What happened in that incident with the Canadian Coast Guard and why you referred to them as pirates?
Actually, I wasn't arrested, but my ship was arrested and two of my officers were charged. And my strategy for this year was to send our vessel into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, but outside of the 12-mile limit in order to document the killing of seals in order to get evidence to present to the European Parliament to back a bill to ban all seal products. We deliberately stayed outside the 12-mile limit, and I deliberately was not on the ship because as a Canadian citizen, that would have given them an excuse to board. So after about 2.5 weeks in the Gulf, the Canadian government responded by attacking our vessel, the Farley Mowat, which is a Dutch-registered yacht, 35 miles offshore, boarded it with armed RCMP officers, a SWAT team, and seized the vessel. Now, when you board a foreign-registered vessel in international waters with an armed body and seize the vessel, there's only one word for that, and that's piracy. And that's what we're charging them with, and that's why we'll be exonerated from any of the charges brought against us once it gets into court, because Canada doesn't have a defense for what they've done.
Now, the government of Canada will try to argue that they need to impose limits as to how close activists and observers can approach sealers, with many Canadians never having seen or will never see a seal hunt. What are the ramifications of this lack of access to this information?
Well, Canada's passed these very Orwellian rules called the Seal Protection Act, which makes it illegal to protect a seal. In fact, it's illegal in Canada to witness a seal being killed, to film it or photograph it without permission of the Minister of Fisheries. And these are censorship laws, if anything. But what's relevant here is that Canada has no right to impose these laws on foreign vessels and foreign crew in international waters. To do so is a breach of international conservation law. They're not going to be able to even get as far as trying the crew on that because they're going to have to present evidence that they took this action in Canadian waters, which they're not able to do. So we're quite confident we're going to win this case.
Now, if you could, please, describe for our audience what is entailed in the seal hunt. I imagine most of us, think of the seal hunt as an industry or is promoted to us through the mainstream media as an industry that provides jobs for people. And so I don't really think that the average Canadian has even an indication of what a seal hunt really is. Can you describe the process for us, please?
The Canadian seal slaughter, I don't call it a hunt, I call it a slaughter. You don't, to hunt animals, you stalk them and everything, but this you walk up to a baby seal that's helpless and smash it on the head with a club. It's hardly a hunt. It's the largest marine mammal slaughter anywhere in the world. And it's also a glorified welfare system because last year the hunt brought in $6 million and cost the Canadian taxpayers $24 million. It's not made money for half a century. It's just continually subsidized by the government. In fact, I've been advocating that the government pay the sealers to not kill seals. You know, we pay farmers to not grow wheat in a starving world. I think that we can certainly pay sealers to not provide fur for the fashion industry. And in fact, we would be saving a great deal of taxpayers' monies if we paid the sealers to not kill seals. But it's an exceptionally cruel industry, and one of the reasons that the European Parliament has a bill before it to ban seal pelts is because of that cruelty. Canada insists it's a humane hunt, but they don't let anybody in there to see for themselves. Last year, they even prevented the European delegation from going out there. We go out there, and we get this evidence despite their regulations, and this is one of the reasons they're so angry. They actually boarded my ship, tore my ship apart, and they're not looking for drugs, they're not looking for weapons, they're looking for photographs and video images. I mean, that's a pretty sad state of affairs when the camera becomes a weapon of subversion.
Now, the government is violating international law, seizing your ship, without proper process. And you're mentioning how we are actually spending more to maintain this seal hunt, which is inhumane. Now, you've also mentioned that in Europe, the seals' pelts are being banned. So what's our market? Where is the market? And why is this continuing?
Well, there really isn't going to be a market. 2 years ago, a seal pelt was worth $105 to the sealer. Last year, it was $66, and this year, it's down to $32. And that's accompanied by rising fuel prices and costs. so they're not making any money. The market is primarily for fashion, and once Europe bans it, that will also mean they can't transship the furs through Europe to Japan, China, or Russia. And also, Europe dictates the fashion trends in the world, so that pretty much puts an end to the seal hunt. Once this bill passes in Europe, the seal hunt will be no more. So we're really seeing the writing on the wall for this, and it's about time, too. I mean, this barbaric industry has no place in the 21st century.
You're listening to an interview with Paul Watson on Sustainable Futures.
One of the issues you face is a lot of anger from local residents in Newfoundland. Apparently, according to the CBC website, they quoted a local resident saying, "It's about time to do something with him before somebody gets hurt." John Anderson, a Trout River resident, said that those comments. Can you expand on the kind of attacks you're receiving for your activism on this issue?
They have nothing to fear about us hurting anybody. I mean, four sealers were recently killed by the incompetence of the Canadian government. We've never injured anybody in our entire history. You know, it seems to me that the government should be more concerned about protecting the lives of the sealers that they're sending out in these flimsy wooden-hulled and aluminum-hulled vessels. I mean, the government says that my vessel is unsafe in there. That's one of the reasons they took measures against it. I have an ice-class steel-hulled vessel that's gone through hundreds of miles of ice pack without any problem, yet the government is sending out these flimsy vessels to get crushed in the ice every year. Every year they lose them. I think five of them have been lost this year and four people killed. So, you know, the policies of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans are not only bad for the management of the resources, but they're killing people. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans is the single most incompetent government body in the country. It has destroyed the fisheries on both the East and the West Coast, and they use the seals and the seal defenders as scapegoats. They want the fishermen to hate us so that they don't put their anger towards the government, which is really responsible for all of their problems.
I guess we understand the world through ecosystems, and we know that every ecosystem depends on, you know, the creatures within it for survival. What are the long-term damage being done by allowing the seal hunt to continue?
What's happened here is that there's been irreparable damage done to the Northwest Atlantic ecosystem. I mean, extreme irreparable damage, especially because of the diminishment of the cod. Canada says that they have to kill seals in order to protect the cod, but this is ridiculous, because at the time Jacques Cartier first came to Canada, there was 40 million seals and no shortage of cod. It wasn't the seals that destroyed the cod. It was greed and the incompetence of the government. Now, cod feed primarily on fish like capelin, which feed upon young cod. So when you reduce seal populations, you increase predatory fish populations of other species that feed on other species, causing a big chain of events, which leads to further diminishment of species like cod. So, you know, Canada sees fish, seals, and people. That's the only things they see. But a simplified food chain chart of the Northwest Atlantic will show about 980 species that are interdependent with each other. Canada is not taking any of these into account. It's all very simplistic with them. They simply want to blame something for their own incompetence, and the seal is what they've chosen to blame. If you want to bring back a healthy fish population, we need to encourage a healthier marine mammal population. But the problem is that the seals are endangered, all seals are endangered, all marine mammals are endangered. It's not just by hunting, it's heavy metal poisoning, pollution, global warming, and the destruction upon the fish upon which they feed. So we're destroying the oceans. Jacques Cousteau said just before he died, the oceans are dying in our time, and we've got to do something about it. He said we have to be aggressive in our defense of the ocean, and that's what I'm trying to do with Sea Shepherd, to be aggressive, but at the same time to be nonviolent. We're proud of our record. We've never injured anybody, but we're not going to say nice things and play all the silly little games and send in petitions and do demonstrations. We're going to intervene, and we're going to uphold international conservation law, and we're going to make people angry. We're going to rock the boat. Sometimes we sink a few, but, you know, we're going to get our point of view across.
Now, you've made a very compelling case for why you do what you do. But what about those who say, you know, hey, listen, the seal hunt provides jobs to an area that desperately needs, and you've alluded to the cost. But what is the actual amount of jobs that is provided by this cruelty?
I think that the seal hunt probably provides a couple of thousand short-term jobs, not lasting more than a few weeks. So enough to probably make everybody eligible for unemployment insurance. but it's certainly not a viable industry. And as I said before, if we paid them to not kill seals, we'd be saving money. So it's certainly from a job perspective, there's nothing there. You know, there are no jobs being provided really in any, that provide any real substance. And in fact, it's costing us even more money because of the boycott in Canadian fish products, which has already cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Snow crab prices in Newfoundland are down in the basement because of this. So in the long run, it's causing much more economic damage to continue to kill seals.
Now, Premier Williams has also been quoted on the CBC website saying the following: other countries are recognizing that these people are dangerous and they're not welcome. And I'm delighted that Canada is finally doing the same thing. He also went as far as calling you a terrorist. How do you respond to this?
I responded to Danny Williams by telling him to either arrest me or shut up. I mean, people throwing this word terrorists around, I mean, I've got no criminal convictions. I've never injured anybody. I'm not wanted in any country. You know, I'm not involved in sleazy scandals like Mr. Williams and a few other politicians I know. The fact is, and then he says, I'm not welcome in Newfoundland. How can he stop me? What kind of arrogant person is this who's trying to tell a Canadian citizen he has no right to enter a part of Canada? We do have this thing called the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and so it sounds to me that Mr. Williams has very little respect for that. But, you know, Mr. Williams just is trying to jump in again because he deflects criticism of the incompetence of his own government by directing that criticism against SEAL defenders and SEALs.
You have put yourself in harm's way countless times, and was there a critical moment in your life that set you off on this path?
Well, you know, I've always been involved with protecting animals. I've always felt a kinship to and an understanding to the laws of ecology. But I think that the one experience that probably solidified this for me was back in 1975 when the Soviets had just harpooned a sperm whale. It was a female whale, and she screamed and rolled in the water, blood everywhere. And suddenly the largest male in the pod rose up, slapped the water with his tail, and disappeared. And he swam under us real fast, and we were expecting him to come up underneath of us. But instead he threw himself out of the water straight at the harpooner at the Soviet vessel, and they were ready for him. And at point-blank range, sent another harpoon into the head of this whale, and blood everywhere. He's screaming, rolling about in agony on the surface of the sea. And as he was rolling about and thrashing about, I caught his eye, and he looked straight at me, and then he dove, and I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming straight at us real fast. And this whale came up and over our little small boat. There was two of us in the boat, and water and blood pouring down onto us, and I looked up into an eye, and in that eye I saw understanding. That whale could have easily have come forward and crushed us, but I could see the effort that he made to pull himself back, and I saw his eye disappear beneath the sea, and he died. And that whale spared my life, and so I'm sort of indebted to him. And I've spent the rest of my life fighting for whales and sharks and seals and fish and the creatures of the ocean. And I don't really care what people think about me or criticize me. As I say, find me one whale that disagrees with what I'm doing, and I might reconsider our tactics. But, you know, people aren't going to convince me to stop doing what I'm doing because people are part of the problem.
Now, here in BC, many people are very angry with our government trying to privatize water, trying to privatize health care. We have an increasing number of homelessness. And clearly, when you feel so strongly about something, sometimes you have to mobilize yourself to take action. What words of empowerment would you share with our audience who are feeling they have struggles that they would like to take on, and perhaps they're just ambivalent because they're afraid or they're unsure as to how to go about it?
Well, you know, Thomas Jefferson once said that when governments are afraid of their people, that's liberty. When people are afraid of their governments, that's tyranny. You know, the fact is that it's people who really make the decision. Governments tend to be the problem.
There's an interview with Paul Watson by Sylvia Richardson. Sylvia Richardson does a program here at CJSF called Latin Waves with Stuart Richardson, who is her husband.
Yeah, that was a great interview, Sylvia. Thanks so much for that. Moving along to another interview we have this week, I did an interview with Michael Brower. He is a faculty member of the School of Environmental Health at the University of British Columbia. And I wanted to do an interview with somebody about environmental health because I'm going through a number of interviews right now and talking to a number of people to kind of lay the foundations of why it is actually so important for us to take care of the environment. Because I think a lot of people hear, you know, environmentalism, or we need to be sustainable and we need to be green and we need to do all of these things, but they're left wondering why, especially for us who live in the city, because we aren't presented on a daily basis with perhaps reasons to care or an understanding of why we actually need to care. So I'm kind of trying to lay the foundation of why do we need to care? And one of those main things is that we need to protect the environment to protect our health.
Mm-hmm. What goes around comes around.
It's important to realize, and you know what, I'm not saying that I'm perfect at realizing it because I live in the city and I often don't experience these things on a daily basis myself, but it's important to understand that what we do to the environment, we do to ourselves. And that's key. And when you think about it, it's intuitive, but it isn't intuitive on a daily basis because we don't think about it on a daily basis when we should think about it.
I think we're surrounded by things that don't follow that logic, and we tend to become numbed by it because of all of the unsustainable practices going on. The intuitive knowledge, although if you take the time to think about it, it's pretty obvious. We're surrounded by things that are contrary to that.
Well, I think that it's really easy to slip into a pattern of just not seeing these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't have to wake up in the morning and say, okay, I need to breathe today. We just wake up doing it. You know, we don't think about, oh, I need to go and get food today. It's in our cupboard. We don't need to think about it. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's really easy to slip into a pattern of numbness. And I'm first to put up my hand to say, I do the same thing. I have a cupboard full of food. You know, some days I would rather be shopping than thinking about the environment. I would rather be shopping for clothes that have been shipped in from another country. And I'm the first to admit that. It's really important to lay those foundations to say, this is why we need to care. And one of those things is our health. There are few things more important than our health. Mm-hmm. We need to care about our health, and directly related to that is caring about the environment. Plain and simple. I'm on a bit of a rant.
It's a good one.
Anyways. Here is my interview with Michael Brower. I'm speaking today with Michael Brower. He is a faculty member of the School of Environmental Health at the University of British Columbia. He's also the former director of the school. Thank you so much, Michael, for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.
So today we're going to be talking about environmental health. You actually focus a lot in your research on air pollution, which I do want to touch on specifically, but kind of more as well environmental health in general. To start off with, based on your knowledge and research in the field of environmental health, can you describe how humans are connected to the environment?
Well, really, we're part of the environment, and I think we often sort of fall into a trap where we think of us and we think of the environment as separate things, but really we're part of it and we depend on the environment. We depend on it for life. So when the environment becomes disrupted, then we become disrupted, like our health becomes affected. So this could mean really direct effects, like if we contaminate the food that we need to eat, the water that we need to drink, the air that we need to breathe, and we in effect get poisoned by it. Or the effects can be more on our way of life and our quality of life. So, for example, we've created the built environment, our cities that we live in, and we've created cities that are automobile dependent. So that means that we tend to get around without any physical activity. So that leads to things like higher obesity rates, leads to changes in our social interaction. So if we're all sitting in our cars every day, we don't interact with the rest of the people in our environment. So really, we're part of this, and what we do to it affects us.
So it's not just about physical health, but then also about mental health as well.
Sure. It even gets more direct than that. Obviously, if somebody's living in an environment that's not aesthetically pleasing, so if they're surrounded by asphalt and tall buildings, that's not as pleasant as where you can see the mountains, you can see the ocean, like we have in the Lower Mainland. And that certainly does affect mental health.
So there's quite a connection between the study of environmental health and something like architecture and urban ecology and that type of thing as well, kind of building in nature around us.
Sure, that's certainly part of it. I think most of the study of environmental health has tended to focus more on those direct interactions, because those that's sort of poisoning, because that's certainly more severe. But there is definitely sort of a quality of life and a mental health part of it as well, and that certainly is part of how we design the places where we spend our time, and for us that is in a built environment that we create.
So then in Canada, what would you consider to be some of the most harmful environmental problems that we are experiencing today?
Well, I think just in terms of the sheer numbers right now, air pollution would actually have to be probably the most important. The estimates now are that air pollution, even in Canada, is associated with somewhere around 6,000 deaths per year. And it also influences asthma, so people who have existing disease or actually creating asthma. It also affects birth outcomes, so there's a link with preterm births and low birth weight babies, childhood infections. The list sort of goes on and on and on. So that's sort of, I think that's the most severe in terms of what's actually happening right now. But in terms of actually the overall importance and the potential for harmful effects, climate change is clearly the most important thing. And that's going to result in health impact as well as just severe disruption to our lifestyle, our economic system, just the way we live. And basically the issue with climate change is, as I see it, is either we can choose to make major changes now that will sort of mitigate some of those future impacts, or we can just wait and see what's going to become. And we'll face major changes in the future that we are likely to be unprepared for.
Okay. Well, I do want to speak specifically about climate change and some of those health impacts that climate change will have. But to go back to air pollution for just a little bit, what are the main sources of air pollution? Because I think of traffic and cars.
For most of the population, that probably is the major source of air pollution. We also have some industrial sources, smelters, cement plants, power plants, but we've actually done a pretty good job of cleaning up the pollution from the sort of large industrial sources. So in most cities, traffic, motor vehicles and trucks, ships, so transportation would be the major source. Also in some of our smaller communities, so for example in northern BC, wood burning for home heating is a major source and a more important source in some of the smaller communities.
What is actually in the air pollution that causes harm? What are the toxins in there?
Well, probably the most important are what we call fine particles. These are small particles that are suspended in the air, and they're mixtures of many, many, many different chemicals, hundreds or thousands of them. And we're still learning exactly how they cause harm, but essentially we breathe them in and our body reacts to them as though they were a foreign object, and it starts a process of inflammation. And it's really our body's inflammatory response that sort of goes out of control that leads to all the health impacts. So that's one very important group of air pollutants. And probably the second most important is ozone, which is a harmful gas that is actually created as a result of reactions in the atmosphere. So some of the pollutants that we release in the presence of sunlight form ozone. And ozone's what's called a very powerful oxidant. And it just destroys lung tissue. So when it comes in contact with lung tissue, it destroys those cells, that tissue, and then we get sensations of difficulty breathing and actually permanent lung damage.
Wow. As a result of all of these health effects, you mentioned that it causes upwards to 6,000 deaths in Canada.
Right.
How quickly has that risen over the past 3 years? Like, has it been at around 6,000 for the last few years, or has it risen quite quickly to 6,000 deaths per year?
Well, we don't really know exactly, and this 6,000 number is an estimate. It's
okay.
Based on statistical relationships between levels of air pollution and levels of death. But what we do know, actually, is that air pollution in Canada has improved from how it was 50 and even 20 years ago. So actually, air quality in Canada today is generally better than it has been in the past. So I would expect that that the number of people dying as a result of exposure to air pollution has also gone down. But of course, there are other factors involved. As our population ages, then we have more people that are sensitive or susceptible to the effects of air pollution. So it's a little bit difficult to give an exact response to that. But I would expect, actually, that in general, air pollution is less of a problem than it was. And I would say over the last 5 to 10 years or so, it's probably fairly stable. And the estimates are that it will keep stable or, in fact, worsen slightly in the future.
Is air pollution hard to regulate? Because, I mean, air is moving. So does that make it harder to regulate?
I think in some ways that makes it harder, but we do regulate it. And actually, I think we've been pretty successful with regulations. As I mentioned, the improvement in air quality in the past, that's really a result of regulations. What's happened, I think, is that we've really been sort of surprised at its impacts, and it seems as though the harder we look, the more we find that air pollution can cause. 10 or 15 years ago, we really thought air pollution was just associated with respiratory disease. Now we're finding really strong links with heart disease, so heart attacks and heart failure, atherosclerosis. Now we're starting to find links with things like childhood infections. I mentioned low birth weight babies, preterm birth, et cetera. So we're just finding more and more impacts of air pollution, and the regulations really just haven't caught up to that. Also, so much of what we actually do creates air pollution. So this is our dependence on a fossil fuel-based economy, and whenever we burn fossil fuels, we create air pollution. So even though we've had a lot of regulations, for example, the emissions out of our cars today are far cleaner than they were 20 years ago. We have so many more cars on the road that we've pretty much eaten away at the effectiveness of those regulations. So we have to actually be more stringent if we're going to make a difference.
How do we make the policies in Canada more stringent? I guess what needs to take place in order for them to become more stringent?
Well, I think the big requirement in Canada, and the one place where we're really lax on is actually sort of enforcement, and the regulations that we have don't really have a lot of teeth if you don't meet them. So, for example, in comparison to the U.S., if a city in the U.S. doesn't meet air quality standards, then that city loses federal funding for transportation infrastructure. So they may lose funding that helps them build roads, et cetera. And in Canada, we don't really have a system like that. So if a city, part of a city, has poor air quality, there's really no mechanism to force that city or that community to actually improve the air quality. And even with that, I think we've been quite successful because we tend to have sort of a multi-stakeholder approach where everyone agrees nobody wants to pollute the air, so we tend to get all the parties together and make an agreement that in general does lead to improved air quality. But I think we could accelerate that if we actually had some penalties and some regulations that had some teeth to them.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Brower on Sustainable Futures. Going back to climate change, you mentioned that things are going to start getting worse if we don't take some action right now. How will climate change actually affect the levels of pollution, or will they affect the levels of pollution in any way?
Well, in terms of air pollution, so climate change will have many effects, but just in terms of air pollution, what will happen is if there's more heat, there's essentially more energy in the system. And some of the pollutants, for example, ozone that I mentioned that are harmful are the result of atmospheric reactions. So if we just have more heat and more energy in the system, those atmospheric reactions are going to occur at a faster rate. So we'll produce more of some of these harmful pollutants just because of actually things being warmer. And then, of course, there are many other health effects of climate change that don't actually have to do with air pollution.
Can you maybe elaborate on some of the major health effects that climate change will cause?
Sure. I think probably the most important is really the direct one, which is heat-related deaths. And it's not something we have to think about a lot in Canada right now. But when we have heat waves, some especially sensitive and particularly the elderly in the population are quite sensitive to the effects of heat. And we have quite strong evidence of heat-related deaths in heat waves from past occurrences. So you may remember several years ago in France especially and in Paris, there was a major heat wave and hundreds if not thousands of people died as a result of that. So if we're going to have hotter summers, for example, we're going to see some heat-related deaths. So that's one, and I think the most important. Also, we're likely to see sort of spreading of infectious diseases, especially diseases that may have been restricted to certain climates, certain ecosystems, such as dengue fever, malaria. They'll actually spread. Some of them may spread into areas where those diseases are not seen today. And we also may see others emerge as well. So one example that's possibly related to climate change is there's been an outbreak around Vancouver Island. It's also spread somewhat to the lower mainland of a tropical fungus called Cryptococcus. And that's resulted in quite a number of actually animal deaths, but also some human deaths as a result of this fungal infection. And this is a fungus that's not historically found in our climate. And there's a thought that it's emerging here as a result of the warmer climate. We've also seen in BC disruption to the forest industry as a result of the pine beetle. We're likely to see disruption to agricultural systems that will affect both the quality of food as well as just our ability to feed ourselves or feed ourselves the foods that we're used to eating. And that's likely to also have health impacts. And also the water supply is affected. If we have warmer temperatures, there's likely to be less water in some locations, so we're likely to have some droughts in some locations. Hard to predict that. And also severe weather, which tends to disrupt infrastructure such as water supply systems. So we may get more contamination of drinking water as a result of severe weather events. So those are just some examples.
Okay, some pretty severe examples.
Yeah.
What then, I mean, climate change is a huge issue, but how do we start to mitigate or plan for some of these events to start occurring?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I think it's really, we could talk about sort of halting climate change, but that's really not practical anymore. This is going to happen. So probably the most important thing from a public health perspective is to really prepare for disasters. And so just as we have earthquake preparedness, we need to really beef up the sort of response to whether it's a heat-related event, whether it's severe weather, beef up our surveillance systems for infectious diseases so that we're ready when these things happen. I wouldn't want to say that we should just ignore the causes of climate change. We need to chip away at those, and that it's really time to take action and stop talking about it. Time to really make some tough changes to our lifestyle, meaning driving less, changing the way we operate our buildings, especially. And in fact, those two things will probably the most important and the easiest things that people can do.
Is there any way for us to be proactive in preventing some of these environmental problems? Because I've read that it is better or easier to be proactive in preventing environmental problems from happening than it is to correct them after they've taken place.
Right. I mean, I think mostly our system right now sort of does try and be proactive, but we obviously need to do more. And I think that The real issue is sort of cost effectiveness. It's not so much that it's easier, but it's actually much more cost effective. We need to think about the fact, let's say, pay for mass transit. It's expensive to increase the energy efficiency of our buildings, but we're actually paying for the costs of not doing that already. So we pay for that in some of these health impacts. So whenever someone, and we can't pinpoint, for example, if somebody comes to the hospital and with a heart attack, that this was definitely caused by air pollution. But we know statistically that some of these heart attacks are related to air pollution. We know that if we actually spend the money to reduce the problem, the source, we're going to save that money in health costs later on. And that understanding really hasn't registered, certainly with the politicians. And of course, it's not in politicians' interest often to sort of think in the long term. But again, it will benefit us in the long term if we make some of those tough choices, spend the money up front now to improve our energy efficiency, those kinds of things. We actually will recoup those costs.
You mentioned a little bit about how environmental health concerns and hazards affect the healthcare system and the economy. How do you foresee that kind of going in the future? Do you see it affecting the economy more and more?
Well, climate change certainly is going to, we're already seeing that with some of the climate change and oil and sort of, you know, our whole fossil fuel based economy is we're seeing the effects right now with high gas prices, high food prices. I mean, unfortunately, for most of the impacts of environmental health, someone doesn't come into a hospital or a physician's office and they say, you know, that's air pollution disease, or that's water pollution disease, or that's food contamination. It's quite difficult to sort of make that diagnosis. But I think that's one of the things that the research and public health research has really done, is it's come up with ways to estimate actually what the impacts are in total, and we can put dollar figures on those, and then that can be used to, again, argue for making some of the regulations, spending the money to improve the environment or lessen the environmental health impact up front rather than paying for it downstream in more drug use, you know, more prescription drug use, more hospitalizations, et cetera. So it's that kind of sort of a policy argument that has taken place. And actually, I think that certainly in BC, the government really has been following that line of thinking. So there's been more money put into preventive medicine, public health, which is some of these things like surveillance and more interaction of the health ministry, the health authorities with the sources of air pollution, rather than just spending all of our health care dollars on treatment. So I think that is registering, and that's actually, things have improved from where they have been in the past.
With environmental health hazards and with humans' connection to the environment, it seems so obvious that what we do to the environment, we do to ourselves as well. What can we do to help people reestablish that connection and help them see that, you know, the more air pollution we pump into the air, or the more toxins we pump into the air, the more we're going to breathe them in and affect our own health?
Yeah, I actually think you hit it on the head with your question. I mean, it is a matter of awareness, and I think for so many people, we've actually lost that awareness, and really that's the problem. For most of our society, we grow up in this built environment that we see as being something that we control, we create. What we do has no effect on this other thing out there, which is the other environment, that is actually what sustains us. So many people have no idea where their food comes from. So that's just on a very basic level, just increasing that awareness of what you actually put into your body, whether it's food, whether it's water, whether it's air, that those things that you need to sustain your life, that what we do might have an impact on those things and on the quality of those things. And I just think people have, because of the way we've set up our society in this urban built environment, most people just in their day-to-day life aren't reminded enough, aren't aware enough of how we get air, how we get water, where does our drinking water come from, where does our food come from, what are we putting into our air? If people really just simply took the time to think about that, the connections are obvious. I think that's really the bottom line, where it's really a matter of improving our own awareness.
Do you have any thoughts about how people can do that?
Well, education is the key, and I think some of the things that we're fortunate to have in the Lower Mainland, where we do have a pretty intimate connection with our natural environment. We see it in the mountains, and in fact, it's very interesting in the Lower Mainland. For a city of its size, the air quality is probably the best in the world. But we have these beautiful mountains that we look at, and when we see air quality degraded, everybody notices, because you can't see the mountains, or there's this layer of brown smog that we have to look through to see the mountains. So having those reminders, creating that sort of built environment that also has some features of natural environment, giving people a means to interact with the environment, I think as part of our urban planning, really will help create that awareness. So stopping to pave over every urban stream that we have, having green space, that's what's needed.
Well, thank you so much, Michael.
My pleasure.
And now for this week's environmental news update. The debate about the U.S. decision to list the polar bear as a threatened species is heating up again. Five industry groups have filed a federal court lawsuit to challenge certain aspects of the U.S. Department of the Interior's decision to list the polar bear as a threatened species. The U.S. Department of the Interior decided to list the polar bear as a threatened species in May this year. The main reason cited for this decision was the threat to polar bear habitat due to the significant loss of sea ice. Five industry groups, the American Petroleum Institute, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Mining Institute, the National Association of Manufacturers, and the American Iron and Steel Institute, filed the lawsuit to challenge the requirement that business projects in Alaska undergo reviews of their greenhouse gas emissions. They argue that this would threaten economic development and jobs in the state. All other states were exempted from these regulations in May. In a press release, the Chamber of Commerce refers to this decision as arbitrary and claims that if this goes unchallenged, jobs and economic growth in Alaska are on the line. The state of Alaska, led by vice presidential candidate and governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, also sued the U.S. government over the decision to list polar bears as threatened because it harms oil and gas exploration in the state. The Center for Biological Diversity, which pushed for the original listing, is also suing to get the polar bear upgraded from threatened to endangered. BC Hydro introduced a new rate plan this week, which is meant to encourage people to conserve energy. With the new conservation rate in place, 70% of BC Hydro's residential customers will pay the same, or less, than with the flat rate in place today. The conservation rate creates a financial incentive for residential customers to reduce electricity use and will help support the BC Energy Plan goal of meeting 50% of future resource needs through conservation by 2020. Currently, BC Hydro customers pay a flat rate for the amount of energy they use. Under the new plan, customers will pay a lower rate for a specified amount of energy over a 2-month billing period. A household will then be charged a higher rate for any excess energy used above the allotted amount of energy. In April 2009, the dual rates will increase. And the United Nations Environment Program is using an innovative method to highlight areas of the world that have undergone dramatic environmental change. Google Earth is providing UNEP with the opportunity to fly people to some of the world's most dramatic hotspots. Highlights include the appearance of road networks in the remote rainforests of the Democratic Republic of Congo and the dramatic expansion of many West African cities. Other highlights presented as a series of before and after images include the surprising changes in the glaciers of Greenland and Alaska and the loss of biodiversity-rich forests to farms in Madagascar. The new program also focuses on more positive environmental projects, such as the reforestation of parts of Niger, to a new management plan for the Itezi Tezi Dam in Zambia, which is helping to restore natural and seasonal flooding. A new study released from Simon Fraser University this week is making a case for leaving old-growth forests alone. According to the study, if we value forests for the services they provide us, such as capturing carbon from the atmosphere, leaving old-growth forests standing is worth more than cutting them down for timber. This is particularly true now that BC is looking for ways to reduce carbon emissions. The report is written by SFU professor and researcher Duncan Noller and is supported by the Wilderness Committee, the David Suzuki Foundation, and EcoJustice. Researchers used computer modeling to look at a variety of conservation and logging scenarios in a large tract of forest near Vancouver. In almost every scenario, researchers say they found the value of carbon captured and stored by the trees far outweighed the value of the lumber harvested from the logs. In particular, the carbon-storing properties of old-growth trees would be useful when the market for carbon credits gets up and running among other Western provinces and states. Within this market system, the trees would bring in a lot more money if they were left standing. And that's been your environmental news update.
So that concludes the show this week. Hope you enjoyed the show.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did want to draw a couple of themes, Ryan, because the two interviews we had today were quite different. But, as with all things sustainable, they are interconnected in some way. So one of the things that I think is key to point out with both of the interviews is that part of the reason why environmentalism isn't front and center is that we have a lack of awareness. There are so many things that are so important to us that we just don't see on an everyday basis, like the seal hunt, like the ocean, what's going on in the ocean, and what is going on in our air and in the environment that directly relates to our health. It's hard to see those connections because they're not tangible, and we live in a very tangible world where we see the things in front of us, and those things that we don't see don't cross our mind. One of the things that I'm starting to realize now is that we need to create that awareness, and we need to create that everyday awareness as well.
It's like needing to make a mantra for yourself every morning and just talk about the ocean and the air and remind yourself every day that those things that you don't see on a day-to-day basis are in trouble.
Yeah, I don't know how to do it. I think that it's a deeply ingrained problem in our society that we need to start addressing. And I look forward to in the future figuring out how to do that and talking to people who are actually doing it. It is there. People are doing this. But it just needs to expand a little.
Okay. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And we are wishing you
a sustainable future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.